center. Grissom.
Ball game over. World Series.
A World Series win.
At 3 feet 7 inches tall, Eddie Goodell became a participant in one of the most outlandish publicity stunts in baseball history when, in 1951, he came to bat for the hapless St. Louis Browns. Although Eddie gained a great deal of notoriety for the stunt, a few years later he became a victim of a senseless murder that remains unsolved to this day. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. Bill Veeck was the P.T. Barnum of Major League Baseball. In fact, his wife, Eleanor Raymond, she'd been an elephant wrangler and horseback rider with the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus. Veeck had a reputation as a master showman and promoter. During his career, Veeck owned several minor league and major league baseball teams, including the Milwaukee Brewers, back when they were a minor league team, the Cleveland Indians, the St. Louis Browns, and the Chicago White Sox. While owner and team president of the Indians, Bill Veeck signed the second African-American player, after Jackie Robinson, to the major leagues, outfielder Larry Doby. Doby became the first black player in the American League in 1947, just 3 months after Jackie Robinson broke the major league color barrier for the National League. Most of the teams owned by Veeck struggled on the field and at the gate. For example, the St. Louis Browns, one of his first acquisitions. They shared Sportsman's Park with the much more successful St. Louis Cardinals. Sadly, the Browns were often in last, both in the league and attendance. In their first St. Louis season, the Browns finished second place. Although they had only 4 winning seasons between 1902 and 1922, they were very popular at the gate during their first 2 decades in St. Louis, and they trounced the Cardinals when it came to attendance. But that eventually changed, and the Cardinals were markedly more popular with baseball fans. If you're wondering how 2 major league teams ended up sharing a ballpark, the story goes back to 1909, when the Browns rebuilt Sportsman's Park as the 3rd concrete and steel park in the majors. To increase their revenue, the Browns' owners leased the park to the other baseball team in St. Louis, the Cardinals. Now, the Cardinals, they were the first team in baseball to develop a farm system of players and were soon winning on a consistent basis, while the Browns languished near the bottom of the league. The St. Louis Browns were to make it to the World Series only once, and that was in 1944, near the end of World War II. Many believe they only won the series because most of the better players on the opposing teams were away serving their country in the war. Many players on the Browns roster in 1944, they were considered 4F, or unfit for military duty. So in 1944, the Browns won the American League pennant and faced their nemesis, the St. Louis Cardinals, in the World Series. The Cardinals won the series 4-2, with all 6 games played in Sportsman Park. This is the only time in history when every game of the World Series was played in one park, and I cannot wait for that question to come up the next time I'm playing trivia. When the war was over, the Cardinals became regulars in the postseason while the Browns struggled on the field and financially. In the post-war era, the only highlight for the Browns came in 1945, when the Browns signed utility outfielder Pete Gray, the only one-armed major league position player in history. In 1951, Bill Veeck, the colorful former owner of the Cleveland Indians, he purchased the Browns from team owner Bill DeWitt. In St. Louis, Veeck extended the promotions and wild antics that had made him famous and loved by many, and loathed by others. Part of this is just who Veeck was, and part of it was a desire to build up their attendance and fan base, to make the St. Louis Browns profitable once again. Veeck had baseball players participate in sack races, 3-legged races, cow milking contests, and a game in which 100 pair of shoes were placed in the middle of the diamond, and the first player to get the 1 matching pair won $50. Veeck was the first owner to implement promotional giveaways. At the stadium, they handed out items like bats, balls, pickles, yes, pickles, lobsters, hot dogs, and ice cream. Veeck gave away plates, televisions, tuxedos, pigs, mice, eels, pigeons, ducks, and one time, the prize was 50,000 nuts and bolts. Among his other promotions were Kazoo Night, On this memorable evening, each person was given a kazoo, and fans were encouraged to play along with the Star Spangled Banner and take me out to the ballgame. He scheduled ladies' nights, teachers' night, cabbie night, bartender night, and even squirrel night, in which 50 squirrels were released on the field, and players would chase them with a butterfly net. For each squirrel they caught, the player received $50. Now, that's like today getting $500 for every squirrel you catch. In 1951, Vec was concerned about how to attract fans to watch the St. Louis Browns play baseball. The giveaways and wacky special events were one thing, but he wanted something big. The team, they struggled to connect with fans. When fans could watch the more successful Cardinals play, Browns ticket sales lagged. Vec knew he had to improvise to draw customers to the ballpark. And it was early in the 1951 season that Vec came up with one of his craziest ideas. He would sign a dwarf to a baseball contract. The idea of using a dwarf or little person appealed to him because the height of the little person meant that the pitcher would not be able to throw a strike and the player would reach first base. Vec wanted people to buy tickets to see the Browns play because the team was fun and unpredictable. To make his promotion work, Vec needed the perfect little person, and he found his perfect little person in Edward Carl Goodell. Edward Carl Goodell, best known as Eddie, was born June 8, 1925 in Chicago, Illinois. He was the second of three children born to Carl and Helen Goodell. Eddie's father Carl was born in Lithuania and immigrated to the United States in 1902, settling in Chicago. His mother, Helen, was born in New York or possibly New Jersey to Polish-born parents. The Goodells were married in 1919 and had three children. Carl supported his family by selling shoes at a department store. Around the time that Eddie was 3 years old, his parents noticed that his growth was stunted. Whether it was from a thyroid problem or some other abnormality is not known. Eddie grew to a maximum height of 43 inches, or 3 feet 7 inches, and he weighed about 65 pounds for much of his life. While Eddie was small, his parents and siblings were all of normal stature and build. Because he was seen as different, Goodell was continually picked on and taunted as a child, and these incidents weren't limited to verbal abuse. They often escalated into fistfights and other maltreatment. Despite the taunting and abuse, he persevered and graduated from high school. However, throughout his life, he was continually insecure and combative about his height and related issues. Eddie often got into fights at local bars when someone would call him half-pint or direct another derogatory term toward him. One time, a group of men were making fun of him in a bar. A drunken Eddie Goodell jumped up on the pool table and started swinging a cue stick at the three men. One of these swings hit his tormentor on the face, requiring several stitches. Without a cue stick to defend himself, Eddie started throwing cue balls at the men until they ran from the bar amid the laughing patrons. It took a lot to intimidate Eddie Goodell. And as an adult, Eddie was able to find employment in a variety of fields that welcomed his uniqueness. He was an errand boy for a local newspaper, the Drover's Daily Journal, and he performed in circuses, rodeos, and other entertainment shows. While the traveling work was consistent, Eddie did not like to travel. He felt ill at ease and feared for his physical well-being away from his comfort zone. During World War II, Eddie worked as a riveter, crawling into plane engines, wings, and other locations where bigger people couldn't fit. This made him an invaluable part of the war effort. Eddie Goodell also was a professional performer. He belonged to the American Guild of Variety Artists. Before his appearance as baseball's most famous pinch hitter, Goodell's most notable gig was when he was hired in 1946 by Mercury Records to portray the Mercury Man. For this gig, he wore a costume which included a winged hat similar to the record label's logo to promote Mercury Recordings. Ad copy said, quote, "I'm Little Eddie, the Mercury Man. Stop in and say hello." Some early Mercury recordings featured a caricature of him as its logo. And these other gigs? They paid the bills, but it was baseball that made Eddie Goodell a legend. And Goodell's baseball legacy? It started in the mind of Bill Vec. Bill Vack worked as a peanut vendor in his youth and later became team owner and president of the Cleveland Indians. He would buy the St. Louis Browns baseball team in 1951. Vack was a consummate showman, always looking for the next bright idea to spark fan interest. We talked about the giveaways and the contests and the prizes, but he wanted something big to draw in the crowds, which got him thinking about someone small. In August 1951, he knew he needed to attract fans for the Browns, who were usually always dead last in the standings and in attendance. He focused on a celebration to honor the 50-year history of the American League, a birthday party of sorts. And for good measure, he decided that his main sponsor, the Falstaff Brewing Company, should be celebrated as well. When, why, and how Vack got the idea of putting a little person on the field is open for conjecture. He started by asking a booking agent to find the right individual. This wasn't as easy as it seemed, because Vack was constantly dissatisfied with the men presented to him. He was adamant about hiring a, quote, midget and not a, quote, dwarf, because he wanted a man who would look somewhat athletic in a baseball uniform. I know, it was the 1950s. It was not a time known for respecting the dignity of people who were different. Vack dispatched his publicity man, Bob Fischel, to find the right man for the job. Fischel sifted through dozens of potential candidates, and they finally selected 26-year-old Eddie Gaedel. Having made their decision, Vack sent his traveling secretary, Bill Durney, to Chicago to pick up Gaedel. Vack insisted that Gaedel's appearance be a complete surprise. And there were two reasons for this. One, as a showman, Vack always loved to surprise the fans, and second, and perhaps more important, if American League officials knew what he was up to, they would stop him. No little person, no big surprise, no ticket-selling headlines for the Browns. American League President Will Herridge, he was a no-nonsense type of guy. He would not stand by and let something take place that could impact the integrity of the game. Herridge would never give his blessing to having Eddie Gaedel come in for one turn at the plate. As Durney neared the Chase Hotel in St. Louis with his important passenger, he told Eddie to hide under blankets. He didn't want anyone to see him with a small man. Vack was clear in his instructions. The priority was protecting the secrecy of the project. Durney did as his boss requested. Eddie was delivered to the hotel room in secret, hidden away in a pile of blankets among other pieces of luggage. Gaedel was given a contract for $15,400, which came out to $100 for the day, which was the scale minimum for a midget act. Gaedel waived the normal 30-day clause that guaranteed severance pay after he was released. Wanting to protect his investment, Vack also took out a $1 million life insurance policy on Gaedel, just in case something went awry. Since the policy was only valid for one day, the cost to Vack was $1.50. Because it was the weekend, Gaedel's contract wouldn't be reviewed by the American League office before Monday at the earliest, so the league office rubber-stamped the contract without really reviewing it. On game day, Gaedel was outfitted in a uniform belonging to Bill DeWitt Jr., the 9-year-old son of the club's vice president. The uniform fit him well and required only one alteration. DeWitt's jersey had the number 6 on the back. Vack had a seamstress remove the 6 and replace it with a measurement, 1/8. While Gaedel was listed on scorecards and programs, the number was written as 18, not 1/8, so no one gave it a second thought. In the hours before the game, Vack met with Gaedel and gave him instructions for his time at bat. He ordered Gaedel to squat low at the plate and not to swing at any of the pitches. The goal was for him to draw a walk. Gaedel crouched, wielding a toy bat and displaying a strike zone described as 1.5 inches in height. An impossible goal for even the most talented pitcher to reach. By game time, Gaedel, who himself was a showman, was revved up for the performance. He was swinging the bat, warming up, and getting into his role. Vack and his crew became worried that the unlikely ball player would set aside the plans and try to hit. He recalled a similar stunt from a minor league game where the unlikely pinch hitter actually connected with the ball, and it took more than a minute for the diminutive runner to reach first base. To ensure Goodell would not try to swing at the pitch, Vec had jokingly told Eddie that he had a sniper stationed in the bleachers with orders to shoot if Eddie tried to take a swing. Between games of a doubleheader on Sunday, August 19, 1951, Vec had a 7-foot birthday cake wheeled onto the field to celebrate the American League. To the joy of the crowd, Eddie Goodell popped out of the cake. Detroit Tigers pitcher Bob Kane took the mound in the bottom of the first inning and warmed up. Browns manager Zach Taylor then signaled for a pinch hitter. That was Goodell's cue. As Goodell strode to the plate, umpire Ed Hurley turned and yelled, "What the hell?" Taylor presented Goodell's contract to the umpire, and, after some confusion and all-around amusement, Hurley called for a pitch. And because of his crouch, Eddie Goodell's strike zone was tiny. In the famous picture of his at-bat, Goodell actually stands somewhat upright, expanding his strike zone. It wasn't what Vec had asked of him, but it didn't matter. Pitcher Bob Kane could not stop laughing and had to call timeout between pitches to pull himself together. Kane's catcher, Bob Swift, walked to the mound and told Kane, "Hey, keep the pitches low." Goodell, a right-hander, walked on 4 pitches and played to the crowd as he jogged to first base. Jim Delsing was sent in to pinch run for the small hitter. Goodell ran off the field to a standing ovation from the 18,000 fans in attendance. While Vec had planned every aspect of Goodell's major league debut, from the uniform to the cake to Eddie's stance at the plate, he overlooked one important detail. He didn't have extra photographers on hand to immortalize the events of the day. When Goodell came to the plate, only one cameraman, a guy from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, was present. Vec had tipped off the paper's reporter, Bob Brogue. This is why there's only a couple of photos available of Goodell's major league debut. While the stunt was a hit with fans, and players on each team found it good for a laugh, the aftermath shook baseball. While many found the incident amusing, about as many were offended. American League President Will Herridge voided Goodell's contract 2 days later, citing, quote, "the best interests of baseball." To milk the publicity, Bill Vec became indignant and claimed in the press that Yankee all-star shortstop and fan favorite Phil Rizzuto, he was nothing more than, quote, "a tall midget." Listeners, Rizzuto was 5'6". Eddie Goodell went along with the righteous indignation, claiming to be the wronged party. He blasted Herridge for ruining his chance at a baseball career. Eddie pointed out the fact that baseball didn't have a commissioner to appeal to. You see, Happy Chandler had recently left office and not been replaced. The following spring, 7 midgets from Hollywood showed up at the Browns' camp and asked for a tryout. The club's new manager, Rogers Hornsby, a no-nonsense type, he wouldn't even let them suit up. Eddie Goodell capitalized on his fame. He appeared on radio and television shows and made personal appearances. Within a few weeks, he had raked in a substantial $17,000. That's more than $150,000 in today's money. For the next few years, Goodell made promotional appearances at ballparks across the country. One of the first of these took place on September 6, 1951, when Goodell was paid for an at-bat at an amateur game in Sycamore, Illinois. He took 2 quick called strikes and berated the umpire for both of them. The pitcher balked and threw another pitch, which Goodell swung at and missed. He left the plate trash-talking the umpire, a far cry from his walk-on in the major leagues. Throughout the following years, Goodell found work because of his fame. He'd once been the face of Mercury Records, and now he served as the Buster Brown Shoe Man, appearing at store openings in Chicago and St. Louis. Eddie also landed a gig with the Wriggling Brothers Circus. Now, had he been willing to live his life on the road, Eddie could have made a very good living. But as we mentioned earlier, he didn't like to travel. He felt unsafe and uncomfortable on the road, strange beds, strange cities. It was too much for him. Hollywood directors wanted him to appear in movies, and Mercury Records wanted him to tour California, but Goodell wouldn't go. Eddie did work for Vec again. On May 26, 1959, Goodell and three other little people landed in a helicopter at Kaminsky Park. They emerged dressed as Martians and carrying ray guns. They ran to the dugout and captured middle infielders Nellie Fox and Luis Aparicio and took them to home plate for a ceremony. On April 19, 1961, just 2 months before his death, Goodell and seven other little people worked as box seat vendors at Kaminsky Park. According to a story in the Chicago Tribune, they quit the gig after just a couple of games, citing, quote, sore feet. Vec hired them after hearing complaints that his usual vendors were too tall, blocking the view of some fans. While showy gigs like this put money in his pocket, Goodell wasn't earning like he used to, and his age was starting to show in his once baby face. Despite his fame, Eddie struggled with the way that some people treated him, mixed with his perceptions of slights both real and imagined. 2 weeks after appearing on the diamond for the Browns, he was arrested for disorderly conduct in Cincinnati where he was performing in a rodeo. Eddie had verbally abused a couple of police officers after they mistakenly asked why, quote, a little boy was out so late at night. Eddie had a temper and quickly became combative, especially after drinking, and his drinking became more and more frequent. He continually engaged in fights and altercations. One relative described him as having, quote, beer muscles. It probably didn't help that Eddie worked as a bartender at the locally famous Midget Club. Yep, the Chicago Midget Club was a real place. It opened in 1948. Chicago native Parnell St. Aubin and his wife, Mary Ellen. They opened the bar. Parnell was best known for his appearance in the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz. Mary Ellen was a Mae West impersonator who worked vaudeville. No, you can't make that up. A little person who was a Mae West impersonator. The Midget Club ran from 1948 until 1982, and the location, on South Kedzie, is now a branch of the Chicago Public Library. Even though he was an adult man in his mid-30s, Eddie lived at home with his mother and brother in an apartment on the south side of Chicago. Goodell stuck close to home, and he was said to be very fond of his mother. And while Eddie was still a relatively young man, his health was failing due to high blood pressure and an enlarged heart. Neither of these conditions were helped by his drinking. Although most baseball fans are familiar with Eddie's famous at-bat, what many don't realize is that Eddie died less than a decade after his first turn as a major leaguer. On Sunday, June 18, 1961, Eddie's mom went to wake him and found that he had passed away in the night. She called the fire department hoping they could revive her son, but there was nothing to be done for him. An inquest was planned because Eddie was covered with bruises on his face, ears, and legs. Could his death be the result of trauma? The coroner's report concluded that Eddie had died of a heart attack, possibly caused by the physical assault upon his body from an unknown person or persons. The only fact ascertained by the police in their brief look at the case was that Eddie Goodell had gone to a nearby bowling alley the previous evening, and while at the bowling alley, he may have had too much to drink. Could he have gotten into an argument or altercation just outside the bowling alley? Or maybe he was assaulted as he made the short walk back to his apartment. Eddie was known to use a shortcut that took him down an alley. It's possible that he was attacked in that alley. Witnesses later reported hearing some shouting, a dog barking, and metal garbage cans thrashing about. Could this have been the altercation that led to the death of Eddie Goodell? Despite these reports, there was no real evaluation performed on Eddie's blood levels in the half-hearted postmortem that followed. His mother had found him lying in bed, deceased. Eddie had bruises on his knees and on the left side of his face and head. The inquest discovered that he'd had a heart attack, which was likely caused by the beating. Almost everything about his death had been concluded by the Chicago police from Eddie Goodell's reputation as a heavy drinker and combative personality. Since money was missing, the Chicago police concluded that Eddie Goodell had been attacked and robbed, but he was able to make it home before collapsing and dying in his bed. The so-called evidence of missing money is not well explained, Nor can anyone confirm how much cash Eddie had on him when he departed the bowling alley that night. Several people at the bowling alley were interviewed and mentioned seeing two strangers drinking and making fun of Eddie. Eddie had threatened to hit one of them with a bowling pin. Because of his so-called reputation, the Chicago Police Department declined to investigate the death of Eddie Goodell further. It appears that Eddie's reputation of being combative allowed some guilty person to get away with murder. Eddie Goodell has been deceased for about 60 years, and it's likely that his assailant has gone on to face his own judgment as well. Eddie's life was filled with highlights and ended in tragedy. A person or persons got away with killing him because police would not investigate the death of a hot-tempered little person. Eddie Goodell was laid to rest on June 20, 1961. Bob Kane, the pitcher on the mound for Eddie's famous at-bat, was the only person from baseball to attend his funeral. Eddie Goodell was interred at St. Mary Catholic Church and Mausoleum in Cook County, Illinois. He was just 36 years old at the time of his death. And listeners, due to its scarcity, Eddie Goodell's autograph now sells for more than Babe Ruth's. And if you live near Chicago, perhaps plan a trip to the Eddie Goodell Bar and Grill in Elburn, Illinois. Team owner Bill Vack? Well, he sold the St. Louis Browns after the 1953 season. The new owner moved the team to Baltimore, where they are now the Baltimore Orioles. Vack had tried to do that for years, but could not get approval from the league. Vack was not done with baseball. He would go on to be the longtime owner of the Chicago White Sox. And Vack continued to be the master of promotion on the south side of Chicago, where he introduced an exploding scoreboard and baseball uniforms that included shorts instead of long pants. If you're going to slide, be careful. Vack hired clowns to entertain crowds between innings and later on became known for hiring attractive, scantily clad ball girls who would chase foul balls between plays. Perhaps his second most famous promotion, besides signing Eddie Goodell, was his 1979 Disco Demolition Night at Kaminsky Park. This ill-fated baseball promotion took place July 12, 1979. At the climax of the event, a crate filled with disco records was blown up on the field between games of the twilight doubleheader between the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. Many of those in attendance had come to see the explosion rather than the game. Anyone who brought a disco record was let in the park for 99 cents. A local disc jockey blew up the records between games of the doubleheader. More than 50,000 people showed up, and the White Sox were not expecting more than 20,000. The drunken crowd became rowdy, they started throwing disco records on the field like frisbees, and finally, thousands of people rushed onto the field after the detonation. The playing field was damaged both by the explosion and by the rowdy fans to the point where the White Sox were required to forfeit the second game of the doubleheader to the Tigers. As a Detroit fan, I find it interesting that the two best-known Vack publicity stunts happened in games where his team was going up against the Tigers. And what you may not know about Vack is that he was a Marine during World War II and lost part of his right leg. He spent the rest of his life using an artificial limb. Bill Vack was a hard drinker and a heavy smoker and described himself as a, quote, baseball hustler. He would remain owner of the White Sox until his death in 1986 at the age of 71. The Dead Ball Podcast was created by Tim Scott. This week's episode was written by Nina Instead and Tim Scott. Chuck Walters is our technical consultant and audio editor. If you're enjoying the podcast, take a moment to leave a rating or review on your favorite podcatcher. It helps other baseball lovers find the show and the stories shared here. To learn more or talk with like-minded baseball fans, join the Dead Ball discussion group on Facebook.